couldn't have come up with that. Of course, we didn't come up with that. The best plan we came up with was to ask Jimmy, wasn't it?
Philip's grimace did not fade. He hunched over, as if fighting back the pain from his arm, and in the limited free space at the bottom of the page, he wrote,
T. Any more paper? P.
After their customary breakfast of wolf jerky and grumbling, they got underway. Philip continued to walk in the lead while the others followed, taking great care in transporting the Mobius blade without losing any digits or blood. None of them grumbled about Philip not helping with the blade, partly because they wouldn't want to trade places with him, since that would mean walking through the desert with a freshly broken arm, and partly because they all understood that having someone who was in some way impaired try to help bear the blade would be a grave danger to the other bearers. The last thing any of them wanted to hear was any of the others saying, "Oops!" The low, undulating hills of the Scapa continued, though Philip thought they were beginning to flatten out a bit. When you spend a long time in the same environment, your mind starts noticing even the slightest variation. Just ask anyone who's ever driven across Texas. The monotony of the same rolling hills, punctuated with the occasional attack from what was essentially the same wolf, was taking a toll on all of their minds. So much so that when there was something genuinely of interest to look at, they took it for an optical illusion at first. As he crested a hill, Philip saw in the distance what appeared to be a few spots of a slightly different shade of very dark brown, which, in the Scapa, constituted scenery. Many steps later, as they crested another hill, it became obvious that the discoloration was a continuous line running parallel to the horizon, a very long way away. The more they walked, and the more hills they summited, the more definite the line became. Philip had been debating whether to say anything to the others. He suspected they were too focused on their footing and trying not to decapitate each other to have noticed the unusual geography of the path ahead. The decision to tell the others came quickly when Philip finally realized what he was looking at. Philip said,
"Better hold up, guys. Chasm."
The others stopped.
"I'm sorry," Jimmy said.
"What?"
"See that line up ahead?"
Philip asked, pointing with his good arm.
"I've been watching it for a while. I figure it's the far rim of a canyon, or a valley, or a chasm."
Tyler finished for him. Gary swallowed hard and said,
"The chasm of certain doom."
"Yes,"
Tyler said.
"Thanks for spelling that out. I'd worried that this would be some other, less dependable doom chasm before we got to the chasm of certain doom. The chasm of possible doom. Something like that."
Gary muttered, "Yeah, sorry."
"The big cartoony gulp was a nice touch," Tyler continued. "It's a shame we don't have a spooky organ to play or a big metal sheet to make some fake thunder every time you say that."
Gary mumbled,
"I said I'm sorry."
Philip peeled his eyes away from the chasm in the distance to look back at his cohorts.
"Okay, guys, there's no need to argue."
Now Gary raised his voice.
"I'm not arguing. I'm apologizing and getting insulted. That's not arguing, is it? Is it, Philip?"
"You're arguing now."
"Well, now, yeah, over the idea that I was arguing, but I wasn't arguing then when you accused me of arguing."
"Okay," Philip said. "I get it."
"I don't even know why I was apologizing. All I said was that it was the chasm of certain doom."
They were all startled out of their bickering by the deafening noise of an eerie organ and fake-sounding thunder. Tyler looked toward the heavens and said,
"Well done. That was fast work."
No chat window opened, but they heard the click of a microphone opening up. Then Todd's voice said,
"Thank you."
27. Gwen didn't like it. Not at all. She didn't like the idea when she heard it. She didn't like the amount of time and effort it had taken to put the idea into practice. She didn't like the jeopardy Martin had volunteered to endure to make the idea work. Of course, she had stated all of these objections before they put it to a vote, and she'd still been outvoted. She didn't like that either. She peered around the wooden barrier at the dust cloud in the distance and said, "This is a bad idea." Britt exchanged a knowing look with Roy and said,
"Maybe so, but it's the bad idea we're going with. Sorry."
Britt, like Gwen, was sitting in the bed of the wagon, which was stationary on top of a rise, well into the charmless scrub desert they didn't know was called the Scapa. After the hill gave out, Roy managed to keep the cart rolling for a surprisingly long time on momentum alone. But still, they were eventually forced to abandon it and continue on foot. They had been delighted to find their friend's footprints, clearly visible and easy to follow. They couldn't understand why the others seemed to be walking in a regular formation, or why there were only four sets of footprints. They decided that one of them must have been injured, and the others were carrying him, which only strengthened their resolve to catch up as soon as possible. They were less delighted when the trail led them to a peculiar-looking mound that suddenly sprang to life and chased them all around the desert. The only time it got close enough to hurt any of them was when it nearly headbutted Roy in the back. Roy was aware of its attack and leapt at the last second, wrapping his arms around the creature's neck. His plan was to cling to the creature and attack its face while it stumbled to a stop. To everyone's surprise, the creature did not stop. It continued running forward while Roy hung around its neck like an albatross. The beast's running stride was not smooth, and it was not long before Roy lost his grip. He threw himself to the side as he fell and avoided being trampled. The monster twisted slightly in the direction Roy had gone, then stopped, scanned its field of view, caught sight of Gwen, and started chasing her with the exact same speed, body language, and intensity it had when it chased Roy. Eventually they stopped the walking pile of dirt by leading it into a fetid little bog they found, and surrounding it while running laps of the bog. The creature didn't know whom to chase, so it just spun around in circles, stirring itself into the water as it slowly melted into loose, watery mud. They knew this was a temporary reprieve. The slop was clearly already trying to reform into some sort of shape that would dry out and continue the chase, but it looked like that would take quite some time. They split up and searched the area, looking for the continuation of their friend's trail, or at least Martin and Gwen did. Gwen found the trail resolving itself from the frenzied, chaotic tracks left from the dust creature's pursuit of both parties. She was a bit unnerved that instead of the familiar, tight, four-person formation, the trail was now a recognizable pattern of three people walking in formation and a fourth walking alone. Gwen called out to the others. Martin was off on his own, also looking for the trail Gwen had found. Britt and Roy were talking. Gwen didn't know what they were saying, but when they heard her say that she'd found the trail, they both smiled in a way that made her nervous. They were the smiles of two people who were sure they knew what to do, and that the first step would be talking you into it. Gwen was right. They were sure that they knew what to do, and they were right. They did have to talk Martin and Gwen into it. They never fully convinced Gwen, but by then she was outvoted. Counterintuitively, instead of following the trail, they backtracked to where they'd left the cart. They spent the minimum time possible repositioning the cart and making modifications, using all of the tools and scrap wood they'd brought, and cannibalizing the sides of the cart in the process. The cart was now a heavily modified flatbed. There was still a small bench by the tiller. Roy sat there, waiting to spring into action. Britt sat cross-legged on the floor of the cart, thinking through the next several hours and trying to hide her excitement. Gwen sat at the back, next to, but not touching, the hastily braced wooden wall that they'd constructed and nailed to the back of the cart. Gwen peered around the wall again and said,
"This is crazy. We're making a mistake."
Roy said, "Oh, come on, Gwen. This isn't a mistake."
"But you agree it's crazy?"
Roy shrugged.
"I don't know. Back when I worked at Lockheed, half the stuff we came up with sounded crazy at first, and most of it was. Some of it actually worked, though. That stuff made it into the planes. we ended up with aircraft that could do things no one else's planes could. Yeah, Britt's plan sounds crazy, but I believe it'll work. Remember, you live in a city made of diamond. That sounds crazy. That was her idea.
Britt smiled. Gwen did not.
Even if the idea might work.
It will,
Britt interrupted.
Even if it might,
Gwen continued.
How are we sure about this barrier? I'm not even allowed to lean against it. How can it possibly hold?
Roy said, I told you. It's not designed to take force from this direction. If you want to get out and lean on it from the other direction, it'll hold all day. You could lean a car's weight on the other side, no problem. I had to prioritize where the stress loads would be. We had limited time and materials.
Gwen looked at Britt and asked,
Does that make sense to you?
Without hesitation, Britt said,
Yes, it does. And even if it didn't, you heard the man. He was an aeronautical engineer at the Lockheed Skunk Works. He has real-world, non-magical engineering experience. Even if I didn't think he was right, I'd defer to his judgment.
Roy said, Thank you.
Britt said,
It's the truth.
Gwen said,
I liked you both more when you liked each other less.
She jumped down off the cart and walked around to the other side of the barrier to look again at what they'd done. The sides of the cart, and most of the spare wood, had been used to make a large, heavy plate, which was affixed to the back of the cart. It was like someone had taken the tailgate off their pickup truck and replaced it with a tabletop from IKEA. What spare wood remained was used to make thick braces that extended from the plank to the bed of the cart at 45-degree angles. Gwen hated to admit it, but it looked as if a great deal of force would be needed to push the barrier over from behind the cart. Of course, if you pushed from inside the cart, the only thing holding the plank on was the grip of the nails, thus the no-leaning rule. One thin plank, similar to a 2x4, leaned against the back of the cart, forming a very narrow ramp to the ground. The plank itself was studded with small strips of wood. They were nailed in at regular intervals all the way up the height of the plank. These were the only parts of the whole apparatus that had been designed and carried out by Martin, and as usual, they were the most seemingly haphazard parts, and Martin was absolutely convinced that they would work. Thinking of Martin caused Gwen to look again at the column of dust headed their way. It was much closer now. Clearly, it was making better time than anyone had anticipated. Gwen watched and saw a small human figure running over the top of a hill, followed by a much larger figure running slightly faster. The larger figure nearly caught the smaller, but at the last second the smaller one made a sharp turn, causing the larger to overshoot, stop running, and look around. The smaller figure stopped and bent over, breathing heavily and keeping an eye on the larger figure. The larger figure finally caught sight of the smaller and attempted to give chase. The smaller leapt out of his way, causing another full stop and confused scan. They repeated this a few times, until the smaller figure felt ready to continue. Then the smaller figure took off on a dead run, straight for the cart.
Okay, get ready,
Gwen said.
Martin's bringing it this way.
Britt said,
Great!
Gwen, please remove the wheel chocks. We're go!
Gwen muttered,
If Martin gets hurt, you're going to be go.
She did as she was told and removed the rocks that were wedging the wheels in place. With that done, she hoisted herself back up onto the flatbed of the cart. Roy sat facing forward on the driver's bench, holding the tiller with both hands as if he expected it to try to wrench itself free from his grip. Britt stood, grasping the brake lever and peeking over the plank at Martin and the dirt monster's approach in the distance. Britt said,
Roy, I'm going to try to give you a countdown from 5, just like we discussed.
Roy said,
Roger.
In the distance, Martin shouted,
Get ready! We're here!
Everybody's enjoying this but me,
Gwen thought.
That means either they're all wrong or I am. Funny. I can't see how either of those ideas should cheer me up at all.
Gwen settled on the flatbed, one hand gripping the side of the driver's bench. The other held the cord that controlled her emergency brake. If things went according to plan, the brake wouldn't be needed. If they didn't, the entire cart would probably disintegrate, making the emergency brake superfluous. It didn't matter. She'd made the stupid thing, and she was going to be ready if the time came to use it. Britt said,
5, 4, 3.
Gwen heard an impact as Martin's foot hit the lone plank that acted as a combination ramp and springboard. She saw his hands grasp the top edge of the shield.
Two?
Martin's feet scrabbled against the toe holds he'd installed.
One!
Martin launched himself over the top like he was vaulting a fence. For a seemingly endless moment, he hung in midair above the cart. Then he started to descend. His legs and pelvis had just fallen lower than the back of the shield when Britt said,
"Impact!"
And the dirt monster rammed into the back of the cart. The shield bucked and creaked, and the cart shot forward. Martin, not being on the cart but rather hovering over it, did not move at all until the top edge of the shield hit him in the lower back. His head, arms, and torso rolled backward, and for an instant it seemed like he might fall over the shield and land on the dirt beast's back. But instead, he balanced, teetering painfully on the splintery top edge of the shield, all of his weight resting on his lower back. He glanced down and saw that the beast was still running, chasing him, and the cart along with him, but that the collision had imparted so much of the beast's momentum into the cart that it was now rolling several feet in front of the creature. Martin knew from experience that the creature would accelerate, and even if it didn't, the cart was rolling downhill now, but would be going up the next hill soon. The creature would hit them again, and if he was still balancing like a human teeter-totter when that happened, he would fall off the cart, and instead of him and his friends using the creature to push their cart across the desert, his friends would use the cart as bleachers, to watch as Martin was trampled to death by Mr. Topsoil. The idea of being stomped on by dirt amused Martin, but not enough to make it happen. Martin grabbed the top of the shield with both hands and pulled, moving his center of gravity forward and scraping the rough wood across his tender lower back. He rolled forward, catching one of the angled braces between the legs. He tumbled to the bed of the cart, landing in a heap at the base of the brake lever. Britt was forced to alter her surfer stance to keep him from taking her feet out from under her. Unfortunately, the beast struck the shield again while she was shifting her balance, and both she and Martin fell back onto the shield, which squeaked and groaned at the sudden load striking it from a direction it was never meant to be struck.
"Brakes!"
Roy shouted.
"Brakes!"
He was fighting the tiller with both hands, trying to avoid rocks and keep the cart from overturning. Britt and Martin both attempted to crawl forward to the brake handle, but the cart reached a trough between two hills, slowed, and the monster struck the shield a third time, pushing them both back and knocking the wind out of them. Gwen let go of the emergency brake cord, knowing that using it in this situation would be disastrous. She threw herself toward the brake lever, pushing it back with both hands. The cart slowed. The hope was that if they slowed the cart enough, they might be able to get the beast to maintain constant contact with the shield. Then they could use its endless energy and enthusiasm for chasing to power them forward. That was the hope. The reality was that Gwen shoved the brake lever as hard as she could, and it slowed the cart enough that instead of sustaining a tremendous blow every few seconds, it sustained a hard blow roughly every second. Roy yelled, struggling to keep the cart upright.
"I think I can start turning this thing around, but we're gonna need more brakes!"
"I'm trying!"
Gwen yelled back, pushing with all her might on the brake lever, eyes squeezed shut with effort. No matter how hard she pushed, the lever didn't seem to move any farther than it already had. Martin got to his feet and joined Gwen, but Britt said,
"It's no good. This is as slow as we're gonna get. We should have beefed up the brakes more."
Roy said,
"Okay, that's a design flaw. We can make this work as is, but we'll remember the problem for Mark II."
"Yeah,"
Gwen shouted,
"'cause we're totally going to do this again someday."
28. Philip lost any doubt that the chasm ahead was the chasm of certain doom when the straight-line route they'd been walking slowly changed to a marked path, paved with what appeared to be bones. Philip was convinced, but that didn't stop the chasm from trying to convince him further. The closer they got to the chasm, the louder it seemed to shout,
"Certain doom!"
After the path of bones, the next sign was the odor. They made a game of trying to describe what it smelled like, and settled on somebody cooking rotten eggs and broccoli in a microwave. A while later, they started hearing the sound. At first, they thought it was a waterfall, but it was way too uneven. When they finally drew close enough to actually look down into the chasm, they saw what the noise was. But by then, they were too distracted by the final, clinching proof that this was the chasm of certain doom. The sight of it. The chasm was deep. Grand Canyon deep. It was easily a mile to the bottom, and at least 4 miles across. The canyon walls dropped at an alarming angle to the dark recesses of the canyon floor. It was midday, and the sun was directly overhead, yet it was dark down there. It was as if the light from the sun could get to the bottom of the chasm, but it didn't want to. Philip couldn't blame it. They would have been looking down into a featureless black morass if it wasn't for the light cast by the river at the bottom of the chasm, which, instead of water, flowed with glowing lava. The four men stood at the edge of the chasm, looking down, joylessly.
"That wouldn't work," Tyler said. "A river of lava wouldn't cut a chasm like this. If anything, it would add rock."
Nobody bothered to agree or disagree. Whether the chasm made any sense or not, it was there, and they'd have to deal with it. Foul-smelling wind blew up from the interior, strong enough to make the remaining tail on Philip's abused fur coat flap like a plastic pennant. Waves of heat and thick dark smoke radiated from the lava, obscuring geological features that, ironically, were only visible because of the light the lava also emitted. What little they could see, they wished they couldn't. The flowing torrent of liquid rock flowed around islands of jagged stones and knife-like spires of glistening black rock. They had no idea how they would traverse the bottom of the chasm, but they knew how they would get down there to try. The bone path had led them directly to the cliff, where it made a 90-degree turn to the left and started a zigzagging path down the wall. The path was narrow. It made the single-file path they'd taken over Cardew Pass seem like a freeway in comparison. Gary asked,
"So, what do we do?"
If he'd been looking at Philip, the question would have been straightforward enough. But he looked squarely at Jimmy as he asked. The note containing Jimmy's thoughts on their predicament had fully made the rounds, and nobody had any objections, or at least any better ideas. He had asked what they would do, but by directing it to Jimmy, in essence, he had said, "I know what we're supposed to do, but what are we really going to do?" Jimmy got the message loud and clear. He peered down at the path. He looked along the cliff's edge to the left as far as his eye could see, then did the same to the right. He looked at the path behind them for anything that might be of use. All he saw was desert, and a tiny dust devil way far off in the distance. Nothing of any use there. He turned to Philip, who had been studying the situation as well. Philip shrugged. Jimmy said,
"We go down the path, Gary. I don't see any other choice."
They spent quite a bit of time trying to figure out how they would carry the blade on such a narrow path. Their standard method of splitting the load and the danger between three of them would not work. They briefly considered just throwing it down like a frisbee and retrieving what was left of it when they reached the bottom, but they remembered Inchgower's admonition that the blade must still be in good shape when they arrived. The idea of reaching the bottom of the chasm only to have some fictional character refuse to recognize the blade was not appealing. Climbing back up the cliff, walking back through the desert, going through all that with the blacksmith and the pumping and the spider again, none of them wanted that. They tried the path and found that the only way it could be comfortably traveled was to walk sideways, leaning back, as if they were walking on a high-rise building's window ledge. They ended up having three men scuttle side by side. The man in front and the man in back would pinch the circular blade, supporting as much weight as they could, but mainly adding control and stability. The man in the middle would hold his well-wrapped hand flat at just about throat height. The blade would rest on this hand, where the blade twisted. He had to hold it at throat height because if he held it any lower, the other two men could not assist him without crawling. The plan worked well, until they reached the first switchback. coordinating a turn for three people carrying something is complex enough, but the path was so narrow and steep that simply maneuvering the blade around the corner was out of the question. Instead, each switchback would cause a tense ballet. Everyone, even Philip with his one good arm, would help move the blade through the switchback with a great deal of effort and insults. All were aware that to touch the blade's cutting edge meant pain at best, and slow, painful death at worst. Quick, painless death was somewhere in the middle. There were countless switchbacks between the cliff's edge and the canyon floor, and before long they had perfected their switchback technique, and their insults. The descent was tedious, terrifying, and irritating, a unique combination that Todd had mastered. The only moments of levity during the entire trip to the canyon floor came when they were attacked by a cliff wolf. They had been descending for less than a half hour when the wolf appeared. Like the desert, the cliff offered no cover to hide the fact that the wolf was materializing out of thin air. Philip saw it first and called out, "Wolf!" as was the protocol. He prepared to fend it off with his one good arm, which would be difficult while walking sideways while clinging to a cliff, but he'd find a way. The others were carrying that cursed blade, and Philip needed to do his part. As with every other wolf on every other part of their journey, the wolf spawned somewhere just off the path, then scanned for someone to attack. Unlike every other wolf on every other part of their journey, this wolf materialized on the side of a sheer cliff. It did materialize over part of the path, but it fell with enough force that it didn't so much land on the path as bounce off of it. First, the wolf didn't exist. Then it was falling. Then it was bouncing. Then it was falling again for quite some time. Then it didn't exist. If it had been a real wolf, it wouldn't have struck them funny. But it wasn't a real wolf, and it did strike them funny. Very much so. It helped that the wolves were so poorly designed and programmed. There was no barking or yelping or attempts to stay on the path. Just an angry wolf snarling all the way to the canyon floor. Wolves attacked several more times while they were on the cliff, and it never stopped being funny. Even the last time, when they were near the bottom and the wolf survived the fall and ran back up the path to attack, something about watching the wolf come all the way back up to where it had materialized in the first place made it that much funnier. By the time they reached the canyon floor, they had lost all track of time. They agreed it had been hours, but none would venture a guess how many. It was dark, but they were at the bottom of the chasm of certain doom. It was going to be dark down here. They had seen with their own eyes that even at midday it was dark. Acrid fumes from the river of molten rock obscured the sky. They knew it was late, but they didn't know how late. What they did know was that they needed to rest. The trip down had been strenuous in every way imaginable. They bedded down on the forsaken hunk of rock where the path ended. It was broad and flat and surrounded with moving liquid rock. The flow was just close enough to be uncomfortably warm without quite starting to burn. On the bright side, no campfire was necessary. Also, the bare patch of solid ground was littered with wolf jerky from all of the cliff wolves that had fallen to their deaths. Tyler volunteered for the first wolf watch while the others got some rest. Later, Tyler woke Jimmy. Gary relieved Jimmy, then Tyler took another turn. Everyone knew that Philip needed more rest, and that he would deny this if asked, so they simply chose to not give him the chance. There had been the usual escalating wolf attacks while they slept. They had all gotten pretty good at sleeping through the sound of a man fending off multiple wolves. They certainly didn't bother to wake each other over something as petty as anything less than 8 wolves. That's why Tyler was the only one who heard a horrible crashing sound coming from the cliff above. They all heard Tyler scream, which caused their lizard brains to take over. They scurried in every direction before even waking up enough to wonder why. They instinctively split their attention between making sure they didn't jump into the lava and looking behind them to see what they were getting away from. They all heard the horrific crashing noise and saw what made it. And suddenly, they were wide awake. 29. They had only been driving across the desert on their dirt monster-powered ox cart for an hour before Martin's rendition of the chorus of A Horse with No Name stopped being even slightly amusing. Of course, it took him another hour to actually stop, but they all knew that irritating everyone else is half the fun of singing. Britt was steering. They had not been going for long when they realized that both steering and braking were far too taxing for any one person to do single-handed without relief. Swapping out the brake position was easy enough, but changing drivers was tricky. The vehicle was not going to stop or even slow down. The monster was pushing them just as Britt had predicted and would continue to until they either wanted to stop or screwed up. Watching the creature chase, then briefly carry Roy, had given her the idea. She saw that the creature's programming was simple.
If the target is in front of you, chase it. If the target's no longer in front of you, acquire target.
She recognized instantly that if they could stay in front of the beast forever, it would chase them forever, possibly pushing them forward at its top running speed, in theory, forever. The dirt creature's top running speed turned out to be about 15 miles per hour, which felt plenty fast. In a car, that would be cruising around a parking lot looking for a space speed. In a slightly modified ox cart with no sides, crossing an unpaved, hill-infested desert in the middle of the night with no headlights, pushed forward by a hulking creature that would stomp you into a puddle of ooze if you fell off, it was more than fast enough. Luckily, the sky was clear and the moon was out. Also, the trail of footprints they had started following had become a relatively well-marked path. It was just narrow enough for the cart to straddle it, and it was paved with some white, reflective, gravel-like material. Britt didn't think it was rock, but she wasn't going to try to stop the cart to identify it. Whatever the stuff was, it shone in the moonlight and made it much easier to follow Philip's party. That was how she thought of it. Philip's party. The others were here to rescue their friends and Jimmy. She was here to rescue Philip and his friends, and Jimmy. She and Philip had been a couple for years, but Philip's circle of friends was still her circle of acquaintances.
That doesn't seem healthy, she thought. It also doesn't seem like Philip's fault.
Britt had only been driving for an hour, but she was about ready to let someone else take over. Her arms ached and her nerves were fried. Roy was on the brakes, releasing them as the cart went up hills and applying them as it coasted down, trying to keep steady contact with the dirt creature's head. The hills and valleys were small, regular, and gentle enough that they had spent some time debating whether you can call an illness seasickness if you got it on dry land. In the end, none of them could agree whether it was seasickness or not, but all agreed that talking about it was not making it better. Martin and Gwen were huddled together in the middle of the cart, resting. Not sleeping. None of them made any pretense at sleeping. The cart was not a relaxing place to be. If someone had asked Britt, she'd have sworn that she was concentrating on the path directly ahead, following the path and trying to avoid any obstacles in their way. That's what she thought she was doing, but subconsciously, she was occasionally scanning the entire area ahead. She kept not seeing anything worth noting, so her brain kept erasing the useless information her eyes had gathered. That's how people get to work with no memory of having driven there. Then, with no warning, Britt thought she saw something. It wasn't really an object. It was more of a discoloration. A vast swath of the desert ahead of them just seemed to be a different color. The moon was putting out just enough light to let her see that something was there, but not enough to tell her what it was. Whatever it was large. As she crested a hill, she saw that it seemed to stretch across her entire field of view. It was miles wide. She still couldn't make out any features, just a line, parallel to the horizon, where the ground's color just changed, and another, closer line, where it abruptly changed back. At the far line, the ground's color lightened and continued to get brighter, bit by bit, until the nearer line.
What is that? She thought. I know I should recognize that.
She stared at it. And she stared at it. And she stared at it. And then, finally, she saw it. Sometimes, When a song is playing on a car stereo that's turned way down, you'll only hear the drums and part of the bass, and you'll think, I've never heard this song before. What is this? Then you'll turn the volume up and listen, confused for a few seconds, before realizing it's a song you know well and have memorized. All at once, the song snaps into clarity, and you can't believe that you didn't recognize it in the first place. Britt felt silly for not recognizing instantly that the thing before them was a vast, deep canyon. But she didn't beat herself up about it. She was far too busy turning the cart as hard as she dared and yelling for Martin and Gwen to shift their weight to the cart's inside edge. The outside wheels left the paved path and plowed through the dirt. The inside wheels spun freely in midair. Martin and Gwen perched on the upper edge of the cart, weighing it down and preparing to jump off if need be. Britt cursed herself for not seeing the canyon earlier. The wheels of the cart came within a few feet of the cliff as they careened past. Running parallel to the canyon, Britt straightened the cart out in an attempt to keep from turning it over and casting all of them into oblivion. Roy, oblivious to the danger, shouted,
"Don't turn so sharp! You'll lose our motor!"
"That's what I'm trying to do,"
Britt replied.
"Why?"
Roy asked. Britt grunted,
"Can't explain. We need to stop."
Roy said,
"Oh, then you'll have to turn sharper."
He looked back at the motor. The creature's poor maneuverability had caused it to drift to the right side of the shield, but it corrected this, found the center again, and was still pushing. Just beyond the dirt creature, Roy saw a vast, yawning emptiness, the bottom of which glowed with fire. He yelped like a startled child, gripped the brake handle tighter, and yelled,
"Okay! I see why we need to stop! Just remember to turn left!"
Britt said,
"I know that, but turning's no good! We're going too fast! We can't turn sharp enough to lose it!"
Britt was busy trying to steer. Gwen and Martin were trying to hold on to the side of the cart bed and looked as if they were thinking about jumping. Roy had a good grip, a good view, and a moment to think. He yelled to Britt,
"Try a diminishing radius!"
Britt instantly understood what he meant. She yelled, "Hold on!" and pushed the tiller to the right. The cart rattled and groaned. The inside wheels stayed on the ground, but only just. Roy tried to help by jamming his full weight into the brakes. He had been babying them, but now he knew it was all or nothing. The cart had reached the end of its usefulness, and he could save the people he was with, or he could save the brakes. It was an easy choice. He peered over the shield and saw that the creature had drifted to the right. Britt slowly pushed the tiller a little farther to the right. Martin and Gwen held on, white-knuckled, to the inside edge of the cart bed, but the force of the turn was pulling them toward the other side. Britt pushed the tiller farther still. Now the left wheels were in the air. Britt feared they would break under the strain. Roy was clinging to the brake lever like a sea captain clinging to the mast in a typhoon. Martin and Gwen looked like they were hanging from the edge of a roof, not lying on the bed of a cart. Roy yelled,
"A little more, Britt!"
He continued leaning hard into the brakes, but he heard and felt a snap. Then the lever went limp. He didn't know what had broken, but the brakes were out of commission. Britt gritted her teeth and pushed the tiller just a hair farther. There was a scraping noise from the shield, and the cart had no power. Britt heard heavy footsteps recede to her right, but she was far more concerned about the cart, which was still teetering on two wheels in the middle of a tight turn, and now had no forward impetus. It teetered for an instant. Britt swung the tiller back past the center, and the cart fell heavily back onto four wheels and coasted forward on its own momentum. Britt closed her eyes and let out a relieved sigh. She drew in a lungful of air, opened her eyes, then shrieked,
"Brakes!"
They had come out of the turn, aimed almost directly at the edge of the canyon. They had lost some speed, but they were still rolling fast enough that jumping off the cart into the darkness in a rocky desert was an unappealing prospect. Roy saw what Britt saw and yelled,
"No brakes! Turn!"
Gwen lurched for the middle of the cart, shouting,
"No! Keep straight! Straight!"
Britt immediately knew what Gwen meant and did as she was told, steering directly for the cliff. Gwen grabbed a stick that was tied to a cord that disappeared between the floorboards of the cart. She yanked the cord hard. Beneath the cart, the cord was tied to a second cord, which was threaded through some small notches in the cart's frame. The second cord terminated on both ends at identical folded bundles of the tough fabric of Roy's former trench coat. The bundles were square and tied up like little gift-wrapped presents. When Gwen pulled the cord, the bows holding the bundles untied. The bundles unfolded into long strips of material 6 feet long and 5 inches wide. The free ends were weighted with lead. The other ends were nailed into the frame of the cart and reinforced. The bundles were positioned in front of the rear wheels. Because the cart was going perfectly straight, when the fabric hit the ground, it was drawn beneath the rear wheels. The fabric pulled tight. The wheels stopped turning. The cart made a sound like it had been hit with a wrecking ball, but the wheels pressed the fabric onto the ground, and the cart came to a stop. Britt said,
"That could have been worse."
The cart was on solid ground. The cliff was still at least 10 feet away. She turned around and smiled at Gwen, who was crouched in the bed of the cart with the ripcord in her hand and a relieved look on her face. Martin laughed. Roy said,
"I knew it would work,"
in a tone of voice that said otherwise, then looked back over the shield behind them. That's when he saw the dirt beast rapidly approaching. Roy shouted, "Jump! Jump now!" Roy led by example, diving off the cart. Gwen and Britt leapt off the cart, landing hard on the desert floor. Gwen looked back to the cart and saw Martin standing as if preparing to jump, but not moving. Martin's right leg twitched rhythmically as he watched the dirt beast closing in. Martin only waited a moment longer than the others, 3 seconds at most, but they were 3 very important seconds. Some of the Earth Elemental's targets had scattered, but one was still directly ahead. The algorithm that governed its actions saw no need to recalculate. It continued running straight ahead at full speed. Martin held the shield wall to brace himself, then glanced to the cliff edge. He waited approximately 1/2 of 1 second, then jumped. The elemental struck at an angle, spinning the cart slightly while shoving it forward. The impact was substantial, and the cart lurched forward with surprising speed. The front wheels of the cart had already crossed into thin air by the time Martin's feet had left the cart. He didn't allow for this sudden forward speed when he calculated his trajectory and found himself flying through the air sideways toward the cliff's edge. He landed on solid ground, but desperately clawed at the soil with his hands while his feet swung out into the abyss. The dirt creature noted Martin's jump and attempted to change its course, but it was far too late. Instead of simply following the cart over the edge, it veered off as if attempting to pass the cart as they both went over the edge and were swallowed by the darkness. Britt, Gwen, and Roy were still too stunned to move. They were panicked from the close call, confused from Martin not jumping with them, impressed at Martin's quick thinking, alarmed at his nearly going off the cliff anyway, delighted when Martin's plan worked, and relieved when Martin came to a stop, safe and sound. Now they were standing there with all of those emotions still swimming in their systems. In the distance, there was a dull, quiet crashing noise as Martin pulled himself to the safety of solid ground and bellowed,
"My name is James Tiberius Kirk!"
Only Gwen got the joke, but that was enough for Martin. The others advanced on Martin, making sure he was really okay. Then they looked over the edge into the canyon below. The floor was alive with flowing rivulets of lava. They branched off of one another, flowed away and around seemingly random dark shapes that were only visible for their failure to emit light, then reconnected to continue flowing down the ravine. They knew that what was left of the cart and what was left of the dirt creature were down there somewhere. But even with the light from the lava, it was impossible to know where in this light and at this distance. Gwen said,
"Roy, not one crack about women drivers, okay?"
Roy said,
"Of course not. One just saved my life."
30. Jimmy asked,
"Was that the Earth Elemental?"
Philip said,
"I'm not sure."
Whatever it was, it had fallen out of the night with almost no warning, along with what appeared to be a large heap of wood and metal. The wood and metal landed frighteningly close to where they'd been sleeping. The other thing landed on the edge of the lava flow and exploded into a cloud of dust. There was a dark spot where it had landed, and for a moment that spot was vaguely man-shaped, but half of it was on the surface of the slowly flowing lava, and the man-shape grew disconnected and deformed. The dust floated, suspended in the air, then began to move, propelled as if by a strong breeze toward the dark spot drifting away in the river of rock. The dust coalesced into a cloud, which compressed into a form and hardened into the earth elemental, which immediately sank to the waist and began melting into the lava. The elemental faced the wizards and moved its arms as if it were walking toward them, but with each passing instant, more of it was consumed into the flow. It would have been tempting to think the creature was merely partially submerged, but the dark brown slick that was spreading out from where its body met the surface of the flow told a different story. The slick grew redder and brighter the farther away from the creature it got, until finally it was just so much more molten rock. The elemental's head was the only part still visible by the time it was pulled around a bend and out of the wizard's view.
"Yep," Tyler said. "That was the earth elemental."
"To think! It reformed and chased us all this way," Jimmy said.
"Yeah, it seems crazy," Philip said. "But that's the only logical explanation."
"Doesn't explain this, though,"
Tyler said, turning his attention to the mangled pile of scrap lumber that had accompanied the elemental back into their lives. After a brief examination, Philip said,
"Looks like it was a cart, maybe?"
Tyler said,
"The cart must have gotten hung up on the elemental at some point between here and where we left it."
"No," Jimmy said. "No. If there'd been a cart between here and the bog where we fought Pigpen, we'd have seen it."
"Yeah," Gary said. "The last cart like that we saw was in Bowmore."
Tyler said,
"Yeah. Wait, what?"
Tyler closed his eyes and sighed.
"Oh, man, he's right. There was a cart in Bowmore. It was the first thing we passed on the way into town."
Philip and Jimmy both closed their eyes, trying hard to remember, and regretting it deeply when they did.
"Why didn't any of us remember that until now?"
Philip asked.
"Never mind that," Jimmy said, looking at Gary. "Why didn't you mention it back when we were looking for a way to carry the blade? You clearly remembered the cart just fine."
"Well, I thought about it," Gary said, "but I realized we couldn't use it."
"Why not?"
Gary shook his head, as if the answer were obvious.
"It was an ox cart. Jimmy, do you have an ox?"
The other three men groaned in unison, like a barbershop quartet whose tenor just called in sick. Tyler said,
"Gary, just because it's meant to be pulled by an ox doesn't mean we need an ox. We could have put the blade in it and pushed it ourselves."
Gary looked at the others, wheels turning in his head. A look of comprehension flickered across his face.
"Wow,"
he gasped.
"Yeah,"
Tyler said. Gary whispered,
"I didn't realize."
Tyler nodded.
"See it now, do you?"
"Yes,"
Gary said.
"You guys really think I'm an idiot, don't you? Of course I considered putting the blade in the back and pushing it. That was the first thing that crossed my mind. Then I thought about it for 5 seconds, and I saw what a bad idea it was."
Tyler said,
"I don't know about that."
"Then let me explain. First off, that cart weighed a ton. It was meant for horses, or oxes, or something to pull, not four out-of-shape guys. It wouldn't have been like pushing a stalled Toyota in a parking lot. We're talking about wooden wheels on rocky terrain. Second, did you look at the path we were going to be traveling? From where we stood at the time, it looked like it was going to be mostly downhill, so we couldn't pull from the front or push it from behind. We'd have had to pull on it from behind to keep it from going out of control, and that would have been really hard."
"Well, maybe
We could have ridden it down the hill,
Philip offered in a quiet voice. Gary shook his head.
That's just dumb. We'd have crashed and broken our necks, even if we didn't have the magic cuts-through-everything blade in the cart with us. Hell, I wouldn't be surprised if Todd left it there for us as a trap, hoping we'd pull a Calvin and Hobbes and kill ourselves.
Jimmy said,
We could have rigged up some brakes or something.
Gary rolled his eyes.
It had a kind of parking brake thing, but it wouldn't have stopped the cart if it had any speed. We'd have had to improve the brakes, and none of us have the know-how to do that sort of thing. No. I see now that I should have mentioned it to you guys, but it wouldn't have changed anything. Now, are we going to stand here questioning every decision I've ever made? Or, since we're all awake now, shall we get on with it?
5 minutes later, they were on the move. As with every other part of the quest, the terrain forced them to go a certain direction. In this case, the spot where they'd slept was surrounded on one side by a sheer cliff, and on two sides by an impassable expanse of hot orange lava. Emitting smoke so thick you couldn't see halfway across the flow, let alone the far bank. The only options were to either climb back up the cliff wall or follow the land along the lava flow's bank for as long as it lasted. It didn't last long. They walked upriver for less than 10 minutes before they rounded a bend. Shortly before the bank disappeared, it was connected to one of the rocky islands in the middle of the flow by a thin, precarious bridge, as if the lava had eroded straight through a large boulder, leaving two islands and a thin tendril of rock between them. Beyond that island, there were many more islands, piles of dangerous, sharp rocks surrounded by dangerous, molten rock. The islands were just different enough from one another to seem essentially interchangeable. Each island was connected to at least one other by a rocky bridge, but many of the islands seemed to be dead ends. They were sure that this was the only way forward, but toward what? They stood and gaped for a moment. Jimmy said,
What could create something like this?
Tyler shook his head.
Some guy wants to make a maze?
Philip crossed the first bridge. It narrowed to only a foot wide in the middle, which would seem easy enough to balance on when you're walking on the ground, but suspended over a moving stream of foul-smelling, fiery death, it might as well have been a tightrope. Tyler, Gary, and Jimmy took turns, two of them carrying the blade across the lava. Like spreading your arms, carrying the blade actually made balancing easier, if more terrifying. Philip's right arm was still in a sling. He had to trust his inner ear to keep him out of the lava. After 2 hours of balancing on narrow bridges while breathing in mystery fumes and roasting from beneath, they reached the far side of the flow. Resting against the black canyon wall, looking back the way they'd came, they couldn't see the far side where they'd started. They had intended to stop and take a breather, but the air quality did not encourage breathing. They had all wrapped whatever fabric they could spare around their noses and mouths, and their inhalation had created black soot stains over their mouths and nostrils. Philip hated the idea that if not for the torn bit of t-shirt fabric stretched over his face, all of that would be in his lungs. He tried not to think about all the stuff that had made it through the t-shirt. They followed solid land for as far as they could, and soon found themselves at the source of the lava. The canyon walls towered over their heads, extended out in front of them, and met at a single point. Beneath that point, a crease where the walls merged ran down to a fountain, spewing wild gouts of lava from beneath the surface of the earth. Viscous orange blobs of hot liquid minerals spurted from the orifice as if the planet's artery had been severed. The sustained roar was low and loud enough that they felt it in their ribcages. The lower part of the spray merged with the existing lava to form the source of the flow they'd been following. The upper portions of the plume hardened and cooled in midair, then rained down, landing with enough force to crack open on the rocks or make small splashes in the lava flow. Some trick of convection caused a steady wind to blow out away from the fountain of rock, pushing all the fumes and particulate debris away from this part of the canyon, to collect in a thick cloud downstream. the very cloud they had just walked through. The flow started fairly high on the canyon wall, then split and flowed around a large, almost perfectly circular expanse of flat, bare rock, large enough to serve as parking space for several buses. The lava flow rejoined itself and continued down the canyon from that point, and there were several more of the rocky islands connected by bridges that all seemed to lead to the large, round island. Also, because of some quirk in the way sunlight filtered down past the surrounding walls and pierced into the shade at the bottom of the chasm, there was a sort of natural spotlight shining in the center of the flat, rocky expanse.
"I may be reading too much into this," Philip said, "but I think Todd wants us to go over there."
"Yes," Jimmy said. "That's what Todd wants."
Jimmy nodded to Philip, then to Tyler and Gary. The closest thing they had to a plan was the simple rule, don't do what Todd wants. But up until this point, they'd had little choice. They had to complete the quest because it was their only hope of getting out alive. Now the quest was all but complete, and they all suspected that Todd would try to kill them anyway. This was their chance. As soon as they saw any opportunity to mess up Todd's plan, they would spring into action, unless that was what Todd told them to do. They stood and scanned the area, examining their goal, the path forward, the ground on which they stood, the canyon walls, and the sky above. Finally, Jimmy sighed and said,
"I think we have to go over there. I don't see a choice."
They navigated across the islands and the narrow bridges to the broad, flat stage. The smoldering fumes seemed to darken and intensify, making the single spot of light stand out even more. They stood along the edge of the stone disk for a long time, looking for the trap they knew was there somewhere. Jimmy held up a single finger, telling the others to wait a moment before they proceeded, which seemed odd to Philip, as none of them had indicated any intention of doing anything. Jimmy let go of the blade, leaving it in the hands of Tyler and Gary, and took one large step forward. Nothing happened. Jimmy took another step, with no result. Jimmy lifted his leg to take another step, and suddenly the air was filled with the same deafening voice that had ordered them to be silent when the quest began.
"You have done well," the voice said, "and now you shall be rewarded. Bring the Möbius blade into the light, and the identity of the Chosen One will be revealed."
Jimmy strolled up to the edge of the spotlight, but did not step into it. Instead, he turned to the others and motioned them forward. There was no need to say that anyone smelled a trap. They were all quite used to the idea that they lived in a trap. This was just the trigger that would spring the trap. The others all moved forward, but stopped well short of the spotlight's edge. Philip said,
"He wants us to bring the Möbius blade into the light."
Jimmy looked at Philip, who mimed the act of tossing something heavy as best he could with one arm in a sling. Jimmy turned and looked at Tyler, who nodded. Gary smiled broadly enough for it to be obvious, despite the fabric stretched over his face, and started to pull the blade from Tyler, but Jimmy stopped him and took the blade himself. Jimmy handled the blade easily. It wasn't heavy, just appallingly dangerous. He told the others to stand back, but they stood directly behind him, so close that their feet were almost touching. Jimmy held the deadly metal hoop in front of him and mentally rehearsed his toss. He closed his eyes and breathed as deeply as he could without coughing. Jimmy opened his eyes, drew back, and gently lobbed the Möbius blade into the light. The blade coasted into the center of the spotlight, then landed flat on the stone surface with a harsh clang. The wizards crouched and huddled together, waiting for whatever would happen. Their heads swiveled, and their eyes darted in every direction, looking for the inevitable attack. They searched frantically for their impending doom. Then they searched in a more confused manner. Slowly, they rose from their collective crouch. Philip said, "Huh." Then, the rocky surface beneath them shattered, and they all fell into the darkness beneath, leaving the Möbius blade alone and unattended in the center of the spotlight. 31. They only fell 10 feet or so, but that was quite far enough. They landed on another stone surface, this one set at an angle, causing them to tumble over one another as they slid down the incline. Philip cried out in pain as his weight came down on his broken arm. The tumbling naturally ground to a halt as the incline decreased. The wizards found themselves battered and disoriented in almost complete darkness.